Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, a parent's back-to-school guide to your kids' social media habits. If you don't know what subtweeting or aggressive liking are, you will want to stay tuned. Also, New York State Democratic gubernatorial primary hopeful Randy Credico today. Now that it's August 26th and finally a little hot outside, we'll take calls from anyone with a summer-related business on the question, how bad is it? But first, new questions in the battle against ISIS. Why can't the U.S. find any allies to bomb Syria, while Egypt and the United Emirates bomb Libya without U.S. consent? And should the U.S. have paid ransom to save James Foley's life? Wall Street Journal Pentagon correspondent Dion Nissenbaum joins us for this. Thanks for coming on, Dion. Welcome to WNYC.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your article today says the U.S. is getting ready to launch surveillance flights over Syria to assess the threat from ISIS and then likely begin airstrikes. We've only been doing this in Iraq so far. What will they be looking for specifically in these surveillance runs?
Well, there's a couple of things they're looking for. I think the first thing they're going to be looking for is ISIS forces that are traveling back and forth between Syria and Iraq. So the forces are coming in from Syria. They're trying to deal with the threat in Iraq, and they'll be able to see these convoys of armored vehicles, MRAPs, and other things that are going from Syria into Iraq. That's one target that they're looking for. They also have been looking for Islamic State leaders like Abu Bakr Baghdadi. Those are known as high-value targets at the Pentagon. Those are always important targets for the U.S. We hit those kinds of targets in Pakistan and in Yemen, as you're well aware. And then finally, they're also looking for training bases and compounds for the Islamic State inside Syria to see basically what's out there and what options they could present to the president for him to consider if he wants to launch airstrikes.
Right. So if the surveillance is to assess the threat, is it possible everyone is overestimating the threat from ISIS, you know, outside that immediate Iraq-Syria border region, that we in the media are going a little crazy with this, not underestimating their ideological extremism or the violent evil that they're committing in their region, but how much of a threat they might be to Americans here or to the rest of the world?
Well, at the Pentagon, I think, you know, you've heard General Martin Dempsey, the America's top general, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, say that he believes they are a regional threat at this point. There are concerns that they could become a global threat. They do have, you know, several thousand Westerners that are part of their forces, and the biggest concern right now is that those people have the passports that allow them to come and go freely, and that they could plot attacks here. But at this point, the Pentagon does feel like they are primarily a regional threat. And when they're looking at the problems and the bases in Syria, that's what they're looking at.
Does ISIS do suicide bombings? I haven't heard of that. But they're probably less of a threat to people outside their region if they're not willing to, say, fly airplanes into skyscrapers?
Well, we certainly haven't seen any kind of planning like that. They do use suicide bombings, you know, in the battlefield
in
Syria, in places like that. Usually, the suicide truck bombs that you'll see going into places, not the sort of walk into a cafe that people might be thinking of, or hijacking a plane. But we haven't seen a sense that they have the capability to orchestrate kind of a 9/11 style attack as of yet.
So you mentioned General Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Let me play a clip of something that he said last week and get your reaction to it. Listen.
To your question, can they be defeated without addressing that part of their organization which resides in Syria? The answer is no. That will have to be addressed on both sides of what is essentially at this point a non-existent border. And that will come when we have a coalition in the region that takes on the task of defeating ISIS over time. ISIS will only truly be defeated when it's rejected by the 20 million disenfranchised Sunni that happen to reside between Damascus and Baghdad.
General Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, and that will come, the bombing in Syria, when we have a coalition. Mm-hmm. So is it necessarily American bombing runs coming, flown by American pilots? We can't get any of the other countries in the region threatened by ISIS, many of them getting U.S. military assistance, by the way, to do this instead of us looking like the big bad empire again?
Mm-hmm. This is a very complicated issue, as you well know, and there's a couple of things at play here. One is that the U.S. could essentially go it alone, and this seems to be where they're heading now, and argue that this is that they would be carrying out bombings on a self-defense justification, meaning that they would be bombing Islamic State forces in Syria under the argument that they would pose an imminent threat to Americans. And that concern has obviously been heightened with last week's
imminent threat to Americans, or, I mean, obviously James Foley was executed, but imminent threat to Americans or hypothetical. I mean, that was the rationale by George Bush for the Iraq War, that someday Saddam Hussein, who was trying to develop nuclear weapons, might develop them, and then someday he might share those nuclear weapons with terrorists who might someday use them against us.
Right.
Is this really much different from that?
Well, I don't want to, that's a hornet's nest there that as a reporter I probably shouldn't jump into. But I would say that you do see America carry out these kinds of operations in other parts of the world now on a limited basis. We've seen operations in Somalia. We see these kinds of operations in Pakistan and in Yemen. And I think that's more the kind of operation we're looking at here, whether the justification for it is legitimate or not. They don't share that kind of intelligence with us or the Americans to really make that assessment. So it's certainly a debate, I think, that Congress will be having with the White House as they look at whether or not they do, in fact, want to carry out these strikes in Syria.
Meanwhile, Egypt and the United Arab Emirates, two of those supposed allies in the region, have carried out airstrikes against Islamist militants in Libya now. This is all over the news today, as you know, reportedly without U.S. consent or even informing the Obama administration. I don't think you've reported directly on this, but have you been paying attention to who they were going after exactly and why the big secret from Washington?
Well, all I know about it is that the Pentagon did not seem to be aware of what was happening with this, and it shows the complications in the region here with regional players trying to address the rise of other extremist forces in other parts of that region. It is interesting that they are certainly willing to go it alone there, and we're facing reluctance from allies such as those to help us out with the Islamic State in Syria.
How do you put that together? Why would they be reluctant to do one and willing to do the other when, in effect, the target is the same, Islamist militants with this kind of ideology interested in taking territory or power from actual governments?
Well, there are a number of complications. The Islamic State, I think, to the region represents much more of a formidable threat than those forces fighting in Libya, which do seem to be fairly well contained in Libya. So I think that more broadly, people in the region see the Islamic State as a more dangerous threat to themselves and their homelands. And we also know that some countries that we would like to participate in bombing operations, both in Iraq and in Syria, also have hostages that are held by the Islamic State. So those countries could also have concerns about getting involved in a military operation where their own hostages could be killed, like James Foley.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and listeners, we're continuing to follow the U.S. versus ISIS story as this continues to develop day by day. Our guest today, Dion Nissenbaum, Pentagon correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and we can take your calls with thoughts and questions, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. On ISIS or Islamic State and James Foley, your article says the Obama administration posture toward ISIS has toughened markedly since the release of that grisly video last week showing Foley's beheading. But horrible as that was, it was one killing in an area where ISIS is killing many defenseless people for many reasons, land and money and intimidation. Why would the murder of Foley change policy more than the bigger picture of what ISIS is up to?
Well, I think that it changed the calculus for the White House here, because this was obviously the first attack on an American. And in that video, the executioner of Mr. Foley said, "You started bombing us in Iraq, and now we're going to turn our weapons on Americans, and we're coming for you, Obama and America." And so the bombing in Iraq has changed the calculus for the Islamic State, and now the White House is trying to figure out how to change the calculus in its response. Now, when the Islamic State actually took over Mosul earlier this year, the Pentagon was saying, and General Dempsey was saying at that time, what he was saying last week, which is that this is a regional threat and you can't deal with it without dealing with the problem in Syria. And I think that the administration was hoping that they'd be able to deal with it with more diplomatic tools, that they could deal with it by trying to create this effort to arm the moderate Syrian rebels that are fighting there. And that's all moving very slowly, and the Islamic State is expanding its reach, and every time you see them expand their reach, the concern at the Pentagon and the White House goes up. So I think that's where we're seeing the change in their calculus.
One interesting thing to me in your answer there is that the death of Foley, as you framed it, the murder of Foley, mm-hmm. was the murder of Foley because he was an American rather than because he was a journalist. Sometimes groups like this will kill journalists to, you know, intimidate other journalists from getting there and reporting what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Would you say this was less of that than killing Foley, who happened to be a journalist, because he was an American representing America?
That's my sense. I'm not in the intelligence world, and I don't know the analysis that's been done, but certainly the people that they've been able to abduct have been primarily American journalists and a small number of American aid workers that are there.
Because that's who goes there,
right,
and takes those risks.
Yes, exactly.
And another American journalist, as you know, was released on Sunday by a different al-Qaeda link group in Syria known as the al-Nusra Front. 45-year-old freelance writer Peter Theo Curtis was freed after being held for 7 months. Again, a journalist, so I don't know if that's a coincidence. And this is a different group that has dissociated itself from ISIS. Did their release of this guy have anything to do with the James Foley video?
It's a bit unclear. The sense that we got was that the family of Mr. Curtis had been trying to deal with the government in Doha, Qatar, for some time to get him out, and certainly their concerns escalated in recent days. It's a little bit murky. We're not exactly sure why things came together so quickly. There are some people who believe that the Nusra Front was trying to distinguish itself from the Islamic State and show that they're not quite as extreme as the Islamic State, which is, you know, quite ironic since they are an al-Qaeda affiliate. And so it's certain different shades of extremism, I would say.
Right. There's this absurd unreality to the idea, if we can linger on this for a moment, that the group that flew airplanes into the World Trade Center is finding one of its affiliates too violent.
Right.
So what was that based on exactly?
Well, it was based on sort of the speed at which they wanted to establish their rule. The Islamic State, as you know, has gone ahead and established what they have declared a caliphate, an Islamic State across Syria and Iraq. And
haven't we heard for the last 15 years that that's what al-Qaeda wants all over the world?
Right, but they had never actually taken the step to establish it. So the speed at which they did it and the way that they are establishing it created some divisions between the two groups.
And the release of the journalist Peter Curtis, I think, also raises another important issue, which is ransom, and when to negotiate with terrorist hostage takers. I guess we don't know for sure if ransom was paid for Curtis, but
right.
You reported that his release was brokered by the nation of Qatar, which paid millions of dollars in ransom to the same al-Nusra Front earlier this year for the release of 16 women. Mm-hmm. So do you know why Qatar paid ransom in that case?
No, I don't know the answer to that. We do know that various nations have paid millions of dollars to these groups, especially those in Europe. A number of European journalists have been freed by these groups in the last year or so. what we believe it was paid for ransom. The U.S. Discourages this. They flatly say that only encourages the abductions of more Westerners. So there isn't a lot of wiggle room in America. American officials do say they don't think they would ever prosecute a family if they paid a ransom to try and get one of their loved ones out in a situation like this, but they do feel that it encourages the groups to do more things similar.
And am I wrong that your article mentioned that the brother of James Foley criticized the United States government for not paying ransom to win Foley's release? Do I have that right?
Yeah, he felt like they should have done more and they should have allowed more. One interesting parallel that he drew was talking about the case of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who was the American soldier who was held for 5 years by Afghan insurgents in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and President Obama authorized the release of five Taliban officials for his return. And James Foley's brother pointed to that as an example of the U.S. willing to go to extreme lengths and make a prisoner exchange to free an American, and felt like maybe the U.S. should have thought about something similar for his brother.
Good point. Did the U.S. respond to that analogy?
I have not seen a response to that yet. My guess would be that they would perhaps point to the difference between James Foley being a civilian journalist who had gone in on his own and put his own life at risk for his work, and Bo Bergdahl being an American soldier who's a representative of the American government is putting his life on his line.
And they did say that, actually, of course, before James Foley, but with the Bergdahl case on its own, that they would go to great lengths to bring home an American service member as a matter of policy. I mean, it's one of the worst moral dilemmas that human beings can face, right? Do you knowingly allow an actual individual like James Foley to be murdered to reduce the incentive to take more potential hostages in the future? And I guess different countries come down on different sides of this moral dilemma. What's Israel's policy? Do you know?
Well, Israel is well known, actually, for making pretty dramatic prisoner exchanges. They've released hundreds, if not thousands of Palestinian prisoners to get back, not just live soldiers, but actually the bodies of their soldiers. So they go to extensive lengths on this, and it's certainly a big debate there. You know, some of the people they've released have, in fact, gone on to become major leaders of Hamas, that they've then turned around and killed in airstrikes as the conflicts there have escalated. So they do release quite a few prisoners in these kinds of exchanges, but it also has a consequence.
Do you think the al-Nusra Front in particular uses hostage taking and ransom as part of their business model? If Qatar was willing to spend, to pay them millions of dollars to get those 16 women back, and now Qatar may have paid them again to get this American journalist Curtis out, or do they commit kidnapping for other reasons? Is this a kidnapping for cash scheme on the part of this Al Qaeda affiliate in Iraq and Syria?
I think that's certainly part of it. They do finance their operations with these kinds of efforts. I think they can use them for both means, both for political ends and also for financial ends. We are seeing the Islamic State expand its ability to finance its operations now that it controls parts of the country. We're hearing that they're selling oil from the regions that they control, and they've been able to get hold of banks where they have the money. So,
but those are relatively conventional commodities compared to hostages.
Yeah, but there aren't that many hostages in people's hands right now, so it can raise several million dollars. I think the estimates I've seen are maybe it's raised $120 million or so of late for these various groups, and that certainly goes quite a ways, but when you're financing an army, you're still going to have to find other ways to pay for it.
Dion Nissenbaum with us, Pentagon correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, as we talk about the world versus ISIS. 212-433-WNYC. And John in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm wondering where Saudi Arabia stands on all this. We never hear a peep from them, at least in the American media. Everybody knows we sell them all kinds of aircraft and military equipment, and also with their great wealth, they never help any refugees that I can see. Turkey does, the UAE does, Qatar helps people. Not a peep or anything in the media about Saudi Arabia. And a lot of people think that their extreme brand of Islam, the Wahhabism, is it fosters many of these problems. So where are we on Saudi Arabia?
Diane?
It's an interesting question. Last week, we did actually see reports that Saudi Arabia had beheaded a dozen or more people, including one who was accused of sorcery. So, you know, you see sort of the establishment of an interesting kind of Islam there. And they are a Sunni nation. The Islamic State is a Sunni force. There aren't any suggestions that Saudi Arabia itself is directly backing the Islamic State, but certainly there are people in Saudi Arabia that are believed to provide financing for them.
Wow, really?
And other parts of the region, for sure. We believe that there are individuals that help in that effort. But it's a complicated relationship, and every time we have a problem in the Middle East, this question comes up. You know, is Saudi Arabia a friend or a foe? As a lot of listeners probably remember that many of the hijackers in 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia.
And what about the Gulf state of Qatar, which we were talking about before as helping to free this American journalist, Peter Curtis? But Qatar is also being identified today as the country that gave the Islamists in Libya the weapons that Egypt and the UAE bombed Libya to try to destroy. So Qatar is negotiating Islamist hostage releases with one hand and giving them weapons with the other?
Yeah, it's a murky, complicated situation in the Middle East. And, you know, there aren't clear good guys and bad guys. Qatar in recent years has tried to become much more of a mediator and a power broker. They've helped try and mediate disputes with the Palestinians. They've helped us out with trying to set up negotiations with the Taliban in Afghanistan. So you do see them trying to become more of a diplomatic force in the region, but like a lot of countries, including our own, they play both a diplomatic and a military game in trying to provide support for the people that they think can help them out down the road.
Basil in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. My comment is this, that not too long ago, Obama wanted to bomb Assad. The Bishop of Damascus at the time said, don't do it. These people are worse. Now we want to bomb the people that we wanted to help, also in Iraq, which, of course, seems schizophrenic. Indeed, all the people that were deposed, these tyrants, in the last several years in North Africa, et cetera, the situation is worse now in Libya, for example, as it is worse in Tunisia, et cetera.
It is. I don't know about Tunisia. Diane, you can say if you want to say anything about Tunisia, but arguably, arguably, things are worse for the average Libyan than they were under Gaddafi. I don't know if that's a fair statement or not with the chaos there. Certainly, things are worse in Syria for the average Syrian than they were when Assad was the unquestioned dictator. But do you then do nothing about dictators? There's another moral dilemma.
Yeah, and this gets to the heart of, I think, the issue for President Obama here is you know, does U.S. intervention, especially military intervention, help or hurt? And in Syria, I think that's where you've seen the reluctance from the president here, because his belief was that if we provided advanced arms to the so-called moderate rebels, that maybe they would end up in the hands of someone like the Islamic State. And then if that operation had failed, then you might have these Islamic State fighters with surface-to-air missiles that could bring down aircraft, and you've made the situation worse, not better.
And for all the guff that President Obama takes over being weak, quote-unquote, this is exactly what he was saying 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who these people are. There are radicals in there who may get their hands on the weapons. We may be making things worse by going in there or arming the rebels. While, you know, the simplistic view, maybe I could say that you can't, is that we're just being weak, you know, even though people, including Hillary Clinton, seem to hold that position. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, just saying. Take another. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No. Well, I just think it's it is complex, and I think what we're seeing now is the also the impact of inaction. You know, there was some hope that they could get the effort along, but the Islamic State has expanded its reach, and now you're seeing the U.S. sort of have to reluctantly get involved in airstrikes.
Right.
And so there isn't an easy solution to this.
Risks on either side of that decision. Suma in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hello, Suma.
Yes, sir. My comment is to admonish the Obama administration to make sure that we do not breach our golden principle not to negotiate with terrorists. And I strongly believe the best way to protect Americans when they go out of the U.S. from kidnapping is to ensure that any terrorist who abduct an American faces the wrath of America as they are doing with ISIS. And ISIS could be a very, very good example to set. And they should go at every length to make sure that ISIS is taught a lesson, and that will make sure that all terrorists scare away from Americans, because according to statistics, only 10% of those abducted for ransom are Americans. They're more likely to abduct French, German, and Spanish tourists when they go to Middle East.
Because those countries negotiate?
Exactly, because those countries negotiate and give ransom for them. We should use the Reagan tactics when they are least expecting it. Let a missile go to their bases and destroy every other base that they have, even within Syria. And when we do that, that will be the best approach with respect to addressing this issue. And Obama was right to be cautious in terms of giving arms to those terrorists in Syria, because what will have happened, ISIS will have been a much stronger force than today if America had done that 2 years ago. So all the hawkies in the Senate, like the John McCain's, they should be put to shame. And I wish somebody will ask them in any interview what will be their position now if Obama had followed their own advice.
But, Suma, let me clarify, because you're saying on the one hand that the hawks like John McCain in the Senate should learn their lesson from what happened. On the other hand, you're saying the U.S. should go in there and teach ISIS a lesson and set an example for the rest of the world. If you mess with Americans, we're going to come after you. So is that different from what McCain is saying?
No, it is different, because McCain's position and the previous hawkies that were in the George Bush's administration, they go in without thinking. Obama's administration think, analyzes before they go in. So they consider that to be weakness, but they don't realize that Obama's approach is the best approach, because you don't just go into a war blindly without analyzing and knowing what the exit will be.
Got it. Suma, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Do call us again. Thank you for your call. We're almost out of time, but kind of to his point about if you get us, we're going to get you. How about the hunt for the guy believed to be Foley's executioner? The guy on the tape with the British accent, tentatively identified as Abdelmajid Abdelbari, an Egyptian Brit known as a rapper who left Britain to fight with Syrian rebels last year, and reportedly, I read, also wrote a theme song for the group Anonymous. I don't know if that's true. And I'm wary of making too much about an individual bad guy when he may fully represent ISIS. But assuming it was coordinated, why Abdelbari as the face to the world?
Well, my guess, and this is just a guess here because I don't know what these people are thinking, but certainly it brings the situation home to Westerners to have an English-speaking executioner on a videotape like this carrying out such a grisly killing. It certainly shows that there are Westerners involved and that they are able to come back to places like Britain and the United States and carry out attacks. There was a similar crime that was kind of overlooked, I think, in the U.S. When a couple of Brits beheaded a British soldier in London some months ago. So the concern gets driven home to the Brits and the U.S. that there are Westerners involved and that they can come bring this back to those countries, and it's not just isolated in the Middle East. And I think that may be what they were the message they were trying to send.
So if Abd al-Bari is captured by the United States as the accused executioner of Foley, what would we do with him? Try him for murder in a U.S. court? Treat him as a terrorist detainee and put him in Gitmo or somewhere? I guess we don't put people in Gitmo anymore, but wherever we put them now. Is that known, what we would do with him if we find him and capture him?
I haven't heard that discussion. Both of those would be possible. You could try them. You could try them in a criminal case, or you could treat them as essentially a prisoner of war. But that hasn't been decided, as far as I know. I don't know if anybody's thinking that far down the road just yet.
International Criminal Court, or would that be more for government officials?
No, I don't think he would be put in that kind of situation.
Right. Well, still unresolved and ongoing, and we'll continue to talk about it, the U.S. and the world versus ISIS and what to do with all the complexities in this situation. Dion Nissenbaum, Pentagon reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much. Great job. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, New York State Democratic gubernatorial primary hopeful and political satirist and civil rights activist, Randy Credico. Stay tuned.